From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, the battle over Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles, where the construction of Dodger Stadium ended up displacing many Latino families.
So very quietly, city officials began working behind the scenes with Walter O'Malley to negotiate the possibility of a relocation from Brooklyn to Los Angeles.
Also a conversation with a Latina pioneer in science, Silvia Acevedo.
When I sat down to talk to her and I said, and I want to be an engineer, she just laughed. She says, girls aren't engineers.
Plus, the story behind the definitive gay anthem in Español.
I think it was just the right time in Spain for things becoming mainstream.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we bring you a collection of great stories that previously aired, but that we feel are worth pulling out of our archives. And we're going to start with the battle over Chavez Ravine. Now, there are still a few more months left before Major League Baseball starts up again. But for those who are missing it, we've got a story for you. What you're hearing is from an electric game at Dodger Stadium in the 2018 World Series between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Boston Red Sox. The Dodgers went on to lose the World Series, but fans lived an unforgettable experience watching the games from the stadium. But often, when you're taking in the game, you're not thinking about the decades-old history of the stadium, especially, for example, an iconic one like Dodger Stadium. So, for some deeper history on the home of the Los Angeles Dodgers, here's producer Janice Yamoka.
So, have you been to a game?
I've been to two games, one when I was like 9 in Chicago, and then one like 10 years ago at Yankee Stadium.
Well, as an Angelino, I've been to Dodger Stadium. It's up on a hill. It's surrounded by palm trees. It has a ton of parking lots. And it has one of the best views of downtown L.A., and the Dodgers have a ton of Latino fans, especially Mexican fans. And a lot of it had to do with Fernando Mania.
Fernando Valenzuela has opened the 1981 season with a shutout.
So Fernando Valenzuela, the superstar rookie, he was a kid from Mexico, Sonora, Mexico. And he led the Los Angeles Dodgers to the World Series in 1981. Fernando Mania was super intense.
And the legend of Fernando becomes known to all the world. Todo el mundo.
My dad, like I said, came during the Fernando Mania. So
that's Vicente Montalvo. His dad immigrated from Mexico in the early 70s and really embraced Fernando Mania. And he wanted to share this moment with his son. So he gave Vicente a Fernando Valenzuela Dodgers jacket on his 9th birthday in front of the whole family, including Vicente's grandfather.
Then my grandpa nearly flipped on him, but he just goes, really? And he walked out of the room. I think he knew he was going to blow up to that point.
Whoa, because of a Dodgers jacket?
Exactly. And Vicente's dad was totally shocked. I mean, it was just a Dodgers jacket. Then Vicente's grandfather did something radical.
My dad was never welcome back into their home.
Because he gave him a Dodgers jacket?
Right. So Vicente, who was 9 years old at the time, he was super confused. And he didn't really understand why his grandfather reacted that way most of his life, until his early 20s, when he finally understood. One day, his grandmother Adela pulled him aside and laid out this entire family history that Vicente had no idea about.
You could see in her face that what she was about to tell me was something that had sat in her mind for a long time. And when she told us about the community, I mean, you could see them, like in their face, you can see them get so emotional.
What does he mean, like the community? Who's he talking about?
Okay, my grandfather is John De Nava, and he grew up in the community of Palo Verde. His wife is Adela De Nava, and she grew up in Palo Verde too, and they both met there.
Palo Verde is one of three neighborhoods that made up a predominantly Mexican-American community. They were Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop, and they had over 1,000 families. And altogether, they made something bigger, something that you may know Maria as Chavez Ravine.
The Chavez Ravine. So it's about a community. Okay.
Today, the rest of the world may know Chavez Ravine by another name.
The lucky ones are here today at Dodger Stadium.
Dodger Stadium.
Okay, Janice, so how about if you take it away and tell us the story of the Chavez Ravine?
So let's talk about it before it was the home of the Dodgers, when it was actually home to over 1,000 families, because it was a place where Vicente's grandparents fell in love and started a family.
My grandma says, you know, well, this was the Luna de Miel. And they always used to talk about stories about how the dances that they used to have in the community every weekend.
It was a lively neighborhood in the 30s and 40s when Vicente's grandparents were growing up.
So there was almost like a party or a disco night out there where they would go and they would have the band playing. And
they even had a house of their own.
They really felt privileged because they had that stepping stone of owning a home.
Overall, life was good for them. And Chavez Ravine, it was located in a valley and it was a little isolated. But overall, it was really close to downtown LA. And even though this was a neighborhood where they threw weddings, quinceañeras, left their doors unlocked, grew their own produce, and even raised their own livestock,
the city had a very different perspective of the Chavez Ravine neighborhoods.
That's Eric Avila, professor of Chicano Studies and History at UCLA. He's the author of the book Popular Culture in the Age of White Flight and has written extensively about Chavez Ravine.
As far back as the 1930s, the City Housing Authority declared the Chavez Ravine to be a slum in need of rehabilitation.
He told me that this was because Chavez Ravine was a low-income neighborhood, not well-served by transit lines, and most of the time lacked basic needs like electricity. People used candles to light up their homes and their streets at night.
So the city in the 1930s targeted the Chavez Ravine for the placement of a public housing project.
And then President Harry Truman was pushing for something called the Housing Act of 1949 as part of the Fair Deal, which gave federal dollars to build housing projects all across the country. Los Angeles got $110 million because of the Housing Act that they could directly use toward public housing. And Chavez Ravine, without electricity, its poor transit, was the perfect site for this.
And this would mean the destruction of the old neighborhood and then the construction of new public housing units in which the old residents would have first dibs to move in.
Here's how it would work. First, they had to get rid of all the residents. Second, they'd have to tear down all the houses. Then, they'd build the public housing and the old neighbors could come back into their new, more modern homes. So by 1950, the Los Angeles Housing Authority sent letters to every home in Chavez Ravine, telling them that their houses were going to be torn down and new ones built in their place. But not to worry. For the many families who qualify for public housing, they'll get first dibs on the new Chavez Ravine once it was done, in about 2 years. It sounded like a good deal, except that saying no was not an option. The city had the power to force them to either sell or get evicted. It's something called eminent domain. What eminent domain basically means is that cities have the power to take private property, as long as it's for public use, like parks or roads, after they pay the owner of that property a fair price. But in many cases, even today, the government tries to lowball property owners, offering only a fraction of the property's value. And the owners could get a lawyer to try to get a better deal, but you need to spend money for that. So in many cases, even when people don't want to leave, they take the deal, which is what many did. And their houses were soon demolished.
By 1952, almost all of the residents had moved out on the premise that they would be able to return to the old neighborhood, moving into these new public housing projects.
Some families resisted, but overall, even if it felt shady, it seemed like a good deal. Think about a college campus, tall towers, lush landscaping, modern structures with modern facilities, electricity, water, the works, everything that the residents lacked in Chavez Ravine. That's what the city told the residents they would get if they sold their homes. So slowly, residents trickled out of Chavez Ravine. Meanwhile, 1 mile south, things were changing at City Hall. The mayorship of LA was about to change, and the new candidate, his name was Norris Polson. He was a congressman that had a ton of well-connected friends like the Chandler family, who owned and operated a little newspaper called the Los Angeles Times.
and they were staunchly opposed to the idea of public housing in the immediate vicinity of downtown Los Angeles.
And there were a few reasons for their opposition. One, they believed that public housing would not maximize the economic value of downtown. And another reason was
this idea of racial integration in the immediate vicinity of downtown.
So Polson, the man running for mayor, made anti-public housing the foundation of his campaign. And he used the Red Scare to attack it. And the rhetoric that he used, public housing was a secret communist strategy to create communist cells in the heart of downtown. That's something that Eric calls red baiting.
And Polson, closely coordinating with the Chandler family, the Los Angeles Times, and other downtown elites, effectively used this red baiting strategy. And he promised that if he won the mayoral election, that one of the first things that he would do in office as mayor would be to cancel the city's bid for public housing.
And then, in 1953, Polson won the election and became mayor. And he kept his promise.
One of the first acts that he signed as mayor was the cancellation of public housing, not just in the Chavez Ravine, but in other parts of the city as well.
So here are hundreds of families who left their homes, and now there would be no promised place to live and no Chavez Ravine. It's important to note that not every family left the neighborhood with a government buyout of sorts. A couple families stayed.
And they were perfectly happy in their home, with their yard and their garden and their livestock and their neighbors, and they had no interest in leaving.
It was basically a ghost town. Most of it had been destroyed, and the ravine sat in limbo. But once the plans for public housing were gone, it made way for something else to be built, something bigger.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue the story of the Chavez Ravine. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at kauffman.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, driven by one goal, ending homelessness for good. Learn more online at melvilletrust.org and on Twitter at Melville Trust.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before the break, we were talking about the history of Dodger Stadium and the land that it's located on, Chavez Ravine. Now, at the time, many residents of Chavez Ravine had sold their homes after being promised public housing. But those plans were canceled by a new mayor, and the ravine itself, where their old homes were, sat in limbo. Here's Janice with the rest of the story.
Over on the East Coast, Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, was unhappy with his location in Brooklyn. The stadium was old, the neighborhood was changing, and New York City officials weren't helping him. O'Malley wanted out.
So very quietly, 1953, 1954, 1955, city officials began working behind the scenes with Walter O'Malley to negotiate the possibility of a relocation from Brooklyn to Los Angeles.
And guess what LA city officials suggested?
The bait, in their negotiations with O'Malley was the Chavez Ravine. And that's when many officials began to see the Chavez Ravine as the perfect site for a modern Major League Baseball stadium, the kind that O'Malley was asking for in New York, but city officials would not give him.
So eventually the City Dodger contract was created in 1958, and it essentially handed Chavez Ravine over to O'Malley as a kind of gift. It was an offer O'Malley couldn't refuse. And that's when it became a full-blown political battle. Mexican-American city councilman Edward Roybal led the resistance.
And his criticism was on behalf of the displaced residents of the Chavez Ravine, saying, how can you argue against public subsidies for decent housing for poor people and then turn around and provide corporate subsidies for Walter O'Malley and the Los Angeles Dodgers by essentially handing the Chavez Ravine over to a very wealthy, very shrewd, very successful negotiator, private businessman like Walter O'Malley.
At the end, all was for naught. The contract was approved in 1958, 5 years after the public housing plans were canceled. It was the final green light for building Dodger Stadium. There was just one thing standing in the way: the families that refused to leave, including the Arechigas, who later became the face of resistance to this eviction. On May 8, 1959, the city of Los Angeles took matters into their own hands. The LA County Sheriff's deputies arrived in a bunch of patrol cars to evict Chavez Ravine's final residents.
And when the people inside the home refused to leave, the sheriffs, with a warrant, went in and physically removed the people from their home.
An old Mexican woman was lifted from a rocking chair. Children were crying. A young woman was dragged out by four deputies, pulling her apart by each limb. Everyone kicking, screaming, and weeping. And once everyone was out, the bulldozers were on scene, ready for destruction. At the time, live broadcast journalism was taking off in the United States, so cameramen and television reporters were on the scene. And the viewers watched with the family as their house turned into rubble.
The broadcast of these images on national television, live images on national television, left a very bitter legacy of racial tension between LA's Mexican-American community and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And this is the legacy of conflict upon which Dodger Stadium was built.
3 years and $18 million later, Dodger Stadium opened its doors on April 10th, 1962.
Opening day, 1962.
That day, the Los Angeles Dodgers lost 6-3 to the Cincinnati Reds. Vicente Montalvo, the man we heard from at the beginning of the story, whose dad gave him a Dodgers jacket, he and most of his family live only minutes away from Dodger Stadium, which stands as a reminder of the shady dealings and violent eviction. His grandparents, his mom, she was about 8 at the time, and her siblings left their home in 1959, right before the evictions became violent. And out of all the memories Vicente's grandmother shared with him, the night his family decided to leave their home always stands out the most.
They were discussing what were the options. Either we leave because they're going to bring force in. They were already threatening them with the sheriffs. So my grandparents said, you know, we got kids. And they said, look, there's only one option we can do, is if we pick up and just give it to them. My grandparents have always told me that we can never use the word compensation. Because in the sense of compensation, they would have been given fair market value. What they were given were peanuts, and that's what they use as peanuts. It was never to justify what the property was worth.
They never became homeowners again.
Because we owned our home, they really thought that they had a piece of the American dream. And what they really found out is that it was an illusion for them. Because the American dream had laws. And some of these laws were like eminent domain. And eminent domain is what took their dream away from them.
Eventually, his grandparents settled in Echo Park, where Vicente grew up, a few miles west of their original home. His grandparents are now in their 90s, and he's still learning new stories about the old neighborhood. Vicente's a founding member of Buried Under the Blue, an organization that's dedicated to preserving the history of the three neighborhoods, Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop. the parts that made up Chavez Ravine that now lie buried under Dodger Stadium. To this day, whenever Vicente's grandfather passes by the stadium...
You know, Grandpa used to go up to the gate every time we passed that darn gate, and he would spit on the floor and he would give them the bird.
He makes his opinion clear.
Our thanks to producer Janice Yamoka for that story. Today, Vicente Montalvo, with the organization Buried Under the Blue, continues to preserve the oral histories of the elders of Chavez Ravine to make sure the stories of their communities stay alive. His grandfather, John, is 98, and his grandmother, Adela, is 94. Hey, John and Adela. And now a conversation with Silvia Acevedo, who went from being an engineer at NASA to the CEO of the Girl Scouts. Silvia Acevedo was one of the first in her family to go to college. She was also one of the first and few Latinas to ever work in NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Today, she's the CEO of the Girl Scouts, and recently she published a book for young adults about her life. It's titled Path to the Stars, My Journey from Girl Scout to Rocket Scientist. I first spoke with her in September of 2017. This week, we revisit that conversation with Silvia, where we talked about her trajectory from Las Cruces to Stanford to NASA and how the Girl Scouts played a role in all of it. Silvia Acevedo, welcome to Latino USA.
Well, thank you very much, Maria. I'm so excited to be here.
You are from New Mexico.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And actually right on the border, right? Las Cruces.
Las Cruces, New Mexico. Some years of our lives, we lived in kind of basically a Spanish-speaking barrio, dirt streets and everything. But that was my life. That was our community, you know, and I loved it.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you kind of throw it out there, you know, dirt streets, kind of, you know, I mean, what you're talking about is a bit of poverty?
Yeah, we lived paycheck to paycheck, let's just say, for a while. And there were a couple times that my dad lost his job. So there were really, you know, rough moments. And that figures in very much of what happened in my family life is that, you know, living in that area, there was a meningitis epidemic that went through that area. And my younger sister, unfortunately, was one of those that was struck with meningitis and kind of changed her brain with the high temperatures. And she became special, but more special in the Special Olympics kind of way. My mom realized that in all of Las Cruces, the only place that there was a meningitis epidemic was in our neighborhood, our dirt street neighborhood. So it took her a couple of years and working really hard and convincing my dad, but we moved to a different part of town where the streets were paved. I saw a girl walking in my neighborhood, and she was going to a troop meeting. And she invited me to come along, and I didn't want to go. And we were in front of my house. So she said, go ask your mom. And back then, my mom had seen I'd gone, become, you know, been a very outgoing, happy girl. And now I was closing the door, locked. I wasn't happy at all. My mom was excited that I was interested in doing something. And I was surprised, but she said I could go. And when I went into the Girl Scout meeting, I just fell in love. There were girls like me, girls doing things. There was order. There was calm. I was just so excited about it. And I felt like light and life came back.
So this very sad circumstance of your sister getting sick actually ends up leading you to interact with the Girl Scouts.
Absolutely. And, you know,
so
if
your sister hadn't gotten meningitis, you might not have interacted with the Girl Scouts.
I know my life would have been a very different thing. You know, everything changed as a result of me being in Girl Scouts. So there's two other major pivotal moments from Girl Scouts. One was cookies, and the other one was earning my science badge.
So I'm sorry, is this a science patch?
I have a science patch, yes.
Is this what it looks like?
Yeah, so my science patch tells my Girl Scout story.
So it's got your name.
Right.
And it's got, like, you know, what's that called?
Well, it's got the atom. It's
the
got
atom,
a rocket ship.
A rocket ship. What's that? Oh, it's got pie, it's got stars.
The stars are because my Girl Scout troop leader saw me looking up at the stars. And so later when we were deciding what badges to earn, you know, my parents had seen me look at the stars and they never thought about, well, so how can you, you know, Sylvia's got an interest in science. So it was just, oh, you looked at the stars. But my troop leader thought, well, you're looking at the stars. You might be interested in science. So why don't you earn a science badge? And I said, I want to earn a cooking badge like all my friends. Because, you know, I was a young girl. I wanted to be like my friends. But she kept encouraging me and telling me you could earn your cooking badge, but let's earn your science badge. And I did that by making Estes rockets. And the first few ones didn't succeed, but they finally did. And I learned that, you know, trial and error, I learned I could do science. I could do math. So at a time when girls like me weren't being encouraged to take science and math, I took all those electives. So when I was in high school, I had decided to be an engineer and I signed up with a college counselor. And she looked at me, she looked in the lobby and she said, what are you here for? And I said, because I'm going to go to college. And she said, no, girls like you don't go to college. When I sat down and talked to her and I said, and I want to be an engineer, she just laughed. She says, girls aren't engineers. But with that confidence instilled by Girl Scouting, I said, if I can cook, I can do science and I can be an engineer.
Can you kind of paint a picture of what New Mexico State University was like?
I went and scheduled an appointment with the head of the industrial engineering department. And when I met with him, he said, well, you've got to be good in math and science. You've got to do well in school. And I said, well, I'm graduating in the top 10 of my class. And here's my scores on the standardized test. He goes, okay. And, you know, at that point, he became very welcoming. But, you know, there weren't a lot of girls. There weren't a lot of women. And I was very fortunate to have won a scholarship that also had a summer fellowship. And even winning that was interesting because when I applied for it, there was no gender associated with it because I think they had assumed only males would go for it. So I won that award. And when I won that scholarship, which was a 4-year scholarship paid for by Sandia Labs, they sent 2 engineers to interview me because they didn't believe that I had filled out the paperwork myself. I remember specifically they wanted to know if I knew how to change the oil in a car, which I did. But they wanted to know step by step.
You talk a lot about girls not being in the world of engineering. What about Latinas and Latinos? Were they there as well?
Not very many. It was really interesting. In 2006, I think someone from Stanford was doing some archives research, and they called me and they said, you're one of the first and kind of one of the few Latinos or Latinas to have ever gotten their graduate engineering degrees from Stanford. And, you know, it really kind of was sort of very eye-opening for me when I was answering their questions and they kept saying, how was it somebody from Las Cruces, New Mexico, because at the time they said we didn't even recruit from there. So how did you know about that, us? That I realized that Girl Scouts had been such a pivotal point in my life and had really given me the tools that transformed me, gave me that courage, confidence, and character, and also gave me the know-how that I could go and succeed. And also that that you can create your own opportunities mindset. So with that, then when I was talking to the folks at Stanford, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, the Girl Scouts has meant so much to me. So then I started getting involved again with Girl Scouts.
So were you, like, seriously the only girl in your classroom?
Sometimes I was. And a fun story was my first summer internship, there were no bathrooms for me. So when I watched Hidden Figures, there's this scene about the women's bathroom.
Everywhere I look, you're not where I need you to be. It's not my imagination. Now, where the hell do you go every day?
To the bathroom, sir.
To the bathroom. To the damn bathroom. For 40 minutes a day?
There's no bathroom for me here.
What do you mean there's no bathroom for you here?
There is no bathroom. There are no...
I mean, the scene in Hidden Figures, watching her run for actually what? It turns out that she was running for like 20 minutes each way just to get to a bathroom for women of color.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because when I first started working and there wasn't a women's bathroom because I was in a test engineering area and they didn't have.
And this is at NASA or where?
No, this was at Sandia Labs. So what happened was when that happened and I didn't have an immediate bathroom available to me, I went into problem solving mode. I didn't go into complaining. I went and said, OK, where are the nearest women's bathrooms? And I realized I needed to bring a bike in so I could get there. But eventually they did bring in a porta potty and it said hers on it.
So you problem solved the problem of not having a bathroom close.
Right.
By bringing your bike to work.
Yes.
To ride your bike to the bathroom.
Yes.
Because this is Sandia Labs, right? I mean,
right,
it's kind of huge.
Time. But, you know, my father had given me really good advice. He said, you know, Sylvia, there is this part of working in an all-male environment. They're going to tease you. They're going to send you on wild goose chases for the left-handed monkey wrench, whatever. He said, always, you know, work hard. Make sure you have a winning attitude. If they haven't assigned you work, that you look for something to do. I'm grateful for that because they really weren't excited that I was there at first at all. I did the things that they didn't want to do. And also I had young eyes. And in test engineering, sometimes they had to look at stuff that was really small and they have magnifying glasses. But me with my 18-year-old eyes was able to read those without any magnifying glasses. So they're like, oh, okay, she can come here and help me on this electrical engineering aspect of the work. And I didn't complain. I problem solved. So when the overalls that we had to wear were too big, I got duct tape and adjusted them. The gloves were too big, but I got duct tape around those so that they would not fall off my hands. You know, it ended up being a really rewarding experience. They liked me a lot.
So you end up at NASA?
Then my first job out of college was at NASA's Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California. Yes.
Can we just spend a little bit of time talking about what it was like to be a Mexican woman, a Mexican-American woman at NASA?
Well, you know, everyone knows your name. So that's something that it's really, you know, or they call you Maria, but they know you and they're aware of you. But, you know, I had a really good manager and his way of managing, he would take me out for hamburgers and he'd say, you know, Sylvia, and this is a very competitive world. And he said, you know, you're going to look around the room and there's not everyone that's going to move ahead and get ahead. And you've got to decide if that's going to be you. And then you've got to do the work and what it takes to get to that next level.
So, you know, this notion that you, with all of this information that you have as an engineer and a researcher working at IBM, at NASA, and then you're like, yeah, I think I'll put my hat in the ring to head the Girl Scouts.
Well, actually, how that happened was after I was on the board for 8 years, our CEO left go after public service. So they asked me to step in as interim. And I was already in love with the organization. And gosh, I've fallen more in love. What I'm really drawn to is I know how much Girl Scouts has meant in my life, and I really want to make sure that we're reaching as many girls as possible because this transforms lives, it transforms destinies, it certainly did that for me.
Sylvia Acevedo is the CEO of the Girl Scouts and author of Path to the Stars, my journey from Girl Scout to rocket scientist. Coming up on Latino USA, we talk about the definitive LGBTQ anthem in Español. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging science and the arts by supporting documentary films such as American Experiences C-Lab, premiering February 5th on PBS. More at sloan.org. And the Zimmel Family Foundation, supporting the National Center for Learning Disabilities, which works to improve the lives of 1 in 5 individuals with learning and attention issues. Learn more at ncld.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Our next story is about Alaska. No, not the state, but the singer behind the definitive LGBTQ anthem in Español. And to start, we're going to take a little trip back in time to Madrid in Spain in the 1970s. Un rayo de sol, oh, oh, oh. ¿Qué pasará? ¿Qué misterio habrá?
Puede ser mi gran noche. En los momentos actuales, su destino providencial.
Spain was ruled under Francisco Franco from the late 1930s until the dictator's death in 1975. And when Franco died,
Españoles, Franco ha muerto.
Democracy was reinstated, ushering in an era of big change. What happened next was a cultural explosion of a repressed youth that became known as La Movida Madrileña. And everything changed. Music, art, fashion, film, and especially nightlife. A young, up-and-coming filmmaker, Pedro Almodóvar, got his start.
I'm the president of the Vomitónica Club. Yeah!
People began to challenge previous social and sexual norms. Drugs were everywhere. And people began to say, Madrid nunca duerme. Madrid never sleeps. La Movida Madrileña gave people a sense of freedom to experiment personally and artistically, and it brought out a sense of self-expression that was missing during decades of censorship. It's often said of La Movida that if you can remember it, you weren't there. No me mires, no me mires, no me, no me, no me mires, no me mires. Musically, La Movida was a mix of pop, punk, and new wave. There were bands like Mecano, Radio Futura, enamorado de la moda juvenil, and A Young Alaska. Bailando. With her band at the time, Alaska y los Pegamoides. Alaska was born in Mexico to a Spanish father and a Cuban mother, both living in exile from their respective dictators. When Franco died, the family moved back to Spain, and Alaska became one of the key figures during La Movida. She mingled and partied with Almodóvar and even appeared in his first film, Pepi, Lucy, Bom y Otras Chicas del Montón. Alaska became an icon for the LGBTQ community, not only in Spain, but throughout Latin America. In fact, one of her greatest hits, A Quien Le Importa, became the official song of the World Pride Festival, held in Madrid in 2017.
Chicos, chicas, pues feliz World Pride, orgullo para nosotras. Viva la vida.
For years, the song has been a pride anthem because of the message in its lyrics. The chorus goes, who cares what I do? Who cares what I say? I am this way, I'll stay this way, and I'll never change. We recently caught up with Alaska for our How I Made It segment, which is about Latino creators and the work they make. We interviewed her at the Cervantes Institute in New York City, where she told us in her own words how she came to be Alaska and about the message behind one of her most enduring hits.
Okay, my name is Olvido Gara, but maybe you know me by my other name, which is Alaska. I was 12 years old, and I didn't like my name, so I thought that was the name I should have. Because it comes from a Lou Reed song. It's a song called Caroline Says.
Caroline Says.
It said all of her friends call her Alaska.
All of her friends call her Alaska.
I'm a girl that was there in 1969 when the man landed on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I wanted to be an astronaut, and I wanted to be a veterinarian. But when I was 12, I was already into Bowie and all that stuff. What made me aware that I can make a band and I can play music was the Ramones. It was not that I wanted to sing because I have a great voice, or I wanted to be an actress because I want to be the best actress in the world. No, I want to belong. I thought it was more of a live that type of life, what I wanted to do. You're just thinking of what you want to do next. In the beginning, it was Bowie, basically. But from that moment on, you can add everything and anything. I love Village People. I love Kraftwerk. I love house music. I love Latin music. And I love sleazy rock and roll. And if you mix all that together, that's me. It's quite amazing because I always try to say what I actually do is pop music. And when you mean pop music, it means something that is done for 1986 or 2012, not for 40 years after that. I didn't really have big dreams, which makes it very easy to succeed, because if you don't have such high things in your mind, you're always succeeding. I know the Ramones didn't fade away, or David Bowie didn't fade away, but it's funny when it happens to you. ¿A quién le importa? Well, that song was just another song in another album. We were quite successful already in Spain and starting to be successful in Mexico and other countries. It was the first single of that album. It was a big success, but that's all. I mean, it didn't mean nothing to no one at the time. Years later, demonstrations in Madrid on the Gay Pride Day, which were like only 200 people gathering together or 500 people gathering together. At the end of the demonstrations, they started singing A Quien Le Importa. One year later, it was 1,000 people, then 500,000 people, 1 million people, and in a very natural way, it became a sort of hymn. I think it was just the right time in Spain for things becoming mainstream, and maybe the song was part of that. I'm not just an icon, if we can say so. I don't feel myself like an icon. I've been dancing in gay bars since I was 14. I'm part of that. I come from the gay underground scene. So it's my life. It's the world I live in. The lyrics say a lot. Everyone can take them to their own story. If this is what I want to do, that's enough. And I never regret it. I mean, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen, but you've already tried it. It's all you can do.
Alaska just celebrated 40 years in the spotlight. She's been with her current band, Fangoria, since 1989. And their latest studio album is called Canciones para Robots Románticos, or Songs for Romantic Robots.
con un nudo en la garganta.
We're going to close out our show with another one of our How I Made It segments. Today, we're going to hear from Jessica Salgado. She's a Los Angeles-based Salvadoran poet. Her first book, Corazón, or Heart, is an intimate look at her childhood, her parents' home country in El Salvador, and her personal experiences of love and loss as a self-described fat brown woman living in L.A. Jessica breaks down one of her poems from Corazón. It's titled, What I Know. And here's Jessica.
What I know. One, all the bus routes that take you in and out of downtown Los Angeles. Two, the names of every street between Silver Lake and Echo Park. The poem was written as a list of things that I know, right? And I'm like, what do I know better than my own city? But even in once listing the things that I know of my city, it became things that I know of myself, and then things that I don't know, because my city's changing. Three, what each corner was before the gentrification. I grew up like really, really immersed in this Southern California Latinx community. And then slowly in my preteen and teen years, things started changing. And my neighborhood started slowly turning into a new neighborhood. It felt like my world was kind of closing in smaller and smaller until eventually I looked up and I didn't really even know the neighborhood I lived in. Four, the corner we found my father on after a diabetic shock. Five, the alley mommy had us walk through the night papi hit her. I've been writing my whole life, so I think by now everybody's gotten used to the fact that I turn everything into a poem. I've grown up in a family that always tells stories. We very much keep part of our history by like, oh, and let me tell you the story about this time that this happened and this time that this happened. So it's a very natural thing for me. The only thing that's different is that I talk about a lot about addiction and abuse within my family that I think my parents used to really cringe at the idea of. Six, the clinic where I saw my first therapist when I was 12. Seven, the parking lot where a drunk papi tried to teach me to drive. Eight, the Rite Aid I got banned from for shoplifting. Nine, the store that does an ID for beer.
I was really interested in capturing being a child and hanging out on my block and having to take care of my dad through his diabetes and my mom and me getting caught for shoplifting, all these things that you do in your adolescence, you know?
10, the old zoo. 11, Griffith Park and its secret corners. 12, Glendale and a shopping mall. 13, Santa Monica Beach and my two sisters. 14, Papi's old car parked on our block. 15, my body a glowing star within it.
And then to have the moment transform where as a woman and I talk about my lovers.
16, my first love and his hands around me. 17, the jacaranda tree where I cried him out of me. 18, the dead end where I took my next lover. 19, the condom wrappers on the 101.
A city will always change for you once you fall in love in it. And then different parts of the city belong to you and that person that you were in love with. All your lovers kind of wear the same face and it becomes your city.
Fairfax and Melrose. 21, another lover and his car. 22, his hand on my knee down Sunset. 23, the apartment in Culver City. 24, the breakup in Westwood. 25,
in Hollywood, 26 on Broadway.
I have a poem that says all of my poems are about love, how I write about my parents, how I write about being bilingual, El Salvador, my body, my dad, his alcoholism, him dying, my grief.
27, the hospital in East LA. 28, the two fetuses it kept. 29, California hospital. 30, my father it kept.
And at the core of all of that, it's this immense love that I feel for the places I belong to and the people that I belong to.
31, the grief I left everywhere. 32, what this city takes. 33, what this city gives.
What this city takes and what this city gives, right? And it's taken so much from me. Like, I lost my father here. I've had medical scares here. I've miscarried children here.
34, what I cannot forget.
I thought that would be a really interesting thing to take on there. Like, yeah, there's different pockets of LA where my heart got broken or where I felt, where I was like immensely in love. And I wanted to talk about that too. And then even then, there's parts of the city where like death found me in different ways. And so all of that happened as I got older. And that's what I wanted to show, that pain and hurt and joy and love find us in different ways throughout the years in different parts of the city.
35, who I was before I knew what I know now, before these palm trees ever loved me back.
Jessica Salgado is an LA-based poet. Her latest book, Tesoro, is out now. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza-Ka, with additional editing by Allison McAdam. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Like, quick, say some. Now, now, say it now. React now. What am I reacting to again?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org. This is NPR.